Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
No, you weren't douchey. You were just kind of passive-aggressive.
Are
about
you serious?
It.
I'm just going to say that Ricky did a great job. I mean, he cares.
Oh, see? That's exactly what I'm talking about right there. Passive-aggressive, mic check.
I'm JP, and this is Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, and we're one of the oldest independent publications in the U.S., distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, and subculture. On this week's episode, the Alt Press Fest, the Underground Gypsy Cabaret, and Soundplay. And now a brief note. Welcome to our one-year anniversary show. Thank you for joining us. At times, I wasn't sure it was going to keep going or if the show would change or if anyone would care to listen, but we recently received first place honors from the Utah chapter of the Society for Professional Journalists, and we're really grateful for that. It couldn't have come at a better time in our show's history, and at this time, I'd personally like to thank the other producers of the show and, of course, Angela Brown for her ideas for the show to begin with and her continued executive producing duties. And, of course, we'd love to thank our listeners. From a few listeners per week, we're now growing exponentially, and this is no mean feat. Thanks again. Now on to the show. The Alt Press Fest is an independent zine festival held in the main library in Salt Lake City, Utah. The library houses the Alternative Press Collection, one of the biggest catalogs of independently published zines in the world, with over 2,500 unique titles and over 6,000 items. The collection inspired Alt Press Fest, a single-day event held at the main library featuring many local-produced zine and chapbooks, along with music, film, panel discussions, and demos throughout the day. Slug writer Dylan Chadwick interviewed library assistant Rachel Getz about the collection and the upcoming festival.
How long has the Alt Press Fest been an event, and what is the library's role in that?
This is going to be the fourth annual Alt Press Fest. The first one was in 2009. So we've been doing it kind of consecutively every year. It was first started by what was called the Alt Press Committee by Clinton Watson, was the first person to decide that the Alternative Press Festival would be a great way to showcase our collection. And then it's kind of spiraled from there into highlighting the community.
From what I know, I mean, this library has like a big zine collection. I mean, is it the biggest? Is it one of the biggest, you know?
What we tell people is it's basically the biggest zine collection in the United States. It's bigger than Portland. It's bigger than New York. We are very proud of how large our zine collection is considering the community that we live in.
Yeah.
And we get zines from all over the world now.
In a sort of a digital internet age, what is A, print media's relevance, and B, specifically alternative press, alternative print media? Why would those still be relevant today?
To me, personally, alternative print media is more relevant than ever because zines and regular printed media, anybody can do it. It's populist. It doesn't require an economic model. Some of these writers, they don't even want to make money. They just want to get their work out there. And there's no mechanism in the capitalist culture for them to do so. So being able to go down to the Kinko's or the Xerox machine at your work or whatever and make something that has your writing in it or your art or your philosophy is more relevant than ever.
Do you specifically have any publications in either Alt Press Fest or just in the zine library generally?
Me personally, no. But that's more just because of me being very busy with all kinds of other things. I wish I could have
sure.
The time.
How can somebody have or submit something for Alt Press Fest? What does that entail?
Well, we have all kinds of tablers and vendors and musicians and all kinds of things. So all you have to do is come and talk to us when we're organizing, which was back in April. We put out a call to all the community, and they responded very well. If you just want to bring in a zine and have it a part of our collection, or even just bring it to the fest and hand it out to people, just come and bring it. Okay. Like, we're not, there's no requirements here. Just come and bring it and hand it out. Because that's kind of what zines do.
Yeah.
What they are. One of my favorite zines is one where a woman just decided to tell stories about her riding public transportation. Mm-hmm. And so she put together a zine and left them out at bus stops.
Oh, great.
For people to just pick up and read her various crazy stories about riding the BART in San Francisco.
Yeah.
It's so much fun, and nobody would. You wouldn't find that in a regular magazine.
No.
Nah. But they're good. They're great stories.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine all of the characters you're going to meet on public transportation. And the other thing about zines that I like is just it's so freeing. I mean, you can say whatever you want, you know? I mean,
right. And sometimes, it's yours. Sometimes it's funny, and sometimes it's sad, and sometimes it's just people's stories. There's no regulations. It's so freeing.
Get a fair amount of art zines in addition to written zines?
Yes. Well. Yes, we do. We get a lot of art zines. Of course, art zines are a little harder to produce because there's a lot that goes into it, especially if you're doing color or you're doing particular kinds of bindings or whatever. We have what we call our special collection of zines, and those are zines that don't go out but are like very ornate and very creative, and even like physical works of art that we wouldn't want to hand out to the populace, but deserve to be displayed somehow. And that's more just up to the individual, what they want to create.
What would you say, if there's any sort of advice to like an aspiring zine maker, what kinds of things would you tell them?
Keep it simple.
Okay.
That's what I would say. It's more about what you are saying in your zine as opposed to like the art and the layout and whatever like printing that you want to have or whatever. Keep it simple, because it's the most simplest zines that are sometimes are the most amazing ones that you can see and read.
Do you have any, besides that one that you just talked about, do you have any that you would like to name drop or mention?
Well, the big one that I name dropped that I found like almost recently is one called Geneva 13. And it's put out by these guys in this town in Geneva, New York. And each issue focuses on one business or one individual in this small town, which is literally only 13 miles long. And they do it for free. And they just put it out for the people in that town to read. And they just put out 600 issues, and they don't charge anything, and they are amazing. It's like reading Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio.
Great book, yeah.
You know, one of my favorite
Absolutely.
Books. And it's this wonderful little zine that I just love.
And how did you find out about it?
That one in particular I found in our collection basically through searching, just looking for it and seeing like the cover and deciding to give it a shot. We have about 6,000 different zines in our collection, which can be very daunting if you're just looking for something.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're good, and sometimes they're not, and sometimes they're you, and sometimes they're not. But when you find a gem like that, just by happenstance, it's a little piece of magic.
Yeah.
That I kind of love.
Generally, do you find that you get a lot of people outside of Salt Lake submitting things, or are people coming and just donating things from their own collections?
We get an equal amount of all. A lot of people still don't know about our collection, which to me is crazy, but then again, I live in a bubble, so what do I know? But we get a lot from the usual places, the Pacific Northwest, and places that have big zinester communities already. They already know about us, so they'll send their stuff in. We've also kind of upped our presence online recently, so hopefully we'll get a lot more from I'd love to see stuff from other countries. All that kind of stuff would be really cool.
So there's no kind of sort of like vetting process. It just has to be an independent zine, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and we do have a standard of quality. Like, you can't just hand in whatever drawings you like, but
yeah.
But we do generally accept everything. It's very rare that we don't accept something
okay. That
somebody submits.
Expect from the experience of Alt Press Fest?
Oh my gosh, there's going to be so much to expect this year. We have such a rich community here. You're going to see screen printers, zinesters are going to be out, artists are going to be out. We have a bunch of awesome bands that are going to be playing outside as well as inside. We have a full schedule of things going on. It's going to be quite the packed 6 hours. We also have a special guest that we're flying in, Esther Pearl Watson and Mark Todd, who are zinesters, artists in their own right, authors about the zine community. They're very well known for writing a book called What You Mean, What's a Zine. They're going to be here doing a presentation as well as a table and signing stuff. So it's going to be a real packed event. I'm very excited for what's coming up.
Yeah, it sounds great.
Yeah.
Where is it? Is it going to happen?
It's going to be at the main library downtown in the urban room, like that big space right in front of the library, as well as out on the plaza. We'll have the bands playing. So it's going to be going on from 3 to 9 p.m. after the library closes, will still be going on.
Is it an opportunity for people with a zine or a publication where anybody can showcase their work, or how does that work?
Well, we do have a designated set of tablers that are gonna be showing off their stuff, and that's all gonna be really awesome. Mm-hmm. If you're an individual who's just come and bring in your stuff, I'm gonna urge you to go ahead and just drop it off and go ahead and don't necessarily expect a table, but feel free to drop off your zines in an area and, you know, we'll put them out and distribute them depending on what people. Hopefully everybody will want your zine.
Absolutely, yeah.
So if you drop it off, I would hope.
The Alt Press Fest happens this Saturday, July 7th, at the main library in downtown Salt Lake, 210 East, 400 South. For a complete schedule of the event, visit slcplaltpress.wordpress.com. And for more info on the collection and the festival, check them out at altpress.slcpl.org. The New Electric Sound is an indie surf rock band based in Provo, Utah. They formed in August 2011 when lead singer guitarist Scott Vance brought together musicians from bands like Bearcats, Paper Torn, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, and The Monikers to form a supergroup. The band released their self-titled debut album on June 26th. From that album, here's Suitcase.
make a backbone on the air. We could say we're sorry on the air. We could say we're not on the air. You could say you love me on the air. I don't care. Tell my heart a million times, and that won't change me none. If we need some time to think, girl, you're not the one. I don't wanna waste my time. I just wanna dance all night. I don't wanna wait for you all of my life.
That was Suitcase from the New Electric Sound. For more info on the band and to download the album and more, visit them online at thenewelectricsound.com. Underground Gypsy Cabaret is a variety showcase held quarterly at Bar Deluxe in Salt Lake City. The show features an array of dancers, hanging performers, magicians, and bands for an extravaganza and performance art. This month, the cabaret will be held on July 13th at 9 p.m. and it's just $7. I'm joined right now by Brian Bonnell and Amanda Borba of the cabaret. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us.
It's great to be here, thank you.
I just wanted to start things off by asking, what is your definition of gypsy?
Wow, of gypsy? Of gypsy. It's kind of a free-thinking, free-moving community. It's kind of an all-inclusive, all-accepting group of people that support all kinds of different ways of looking at things, different ways of expressing, different ways of painting, singing, dancing. It's more a state of mind, I think.
I would say in the sense that we're using it, that's about right, that it's really about like being creative and having a community and enjoying life and doing fun things with your gypsy family, which is kind of just your friends and colleagues. And in the way that we're using it, yes, that's what I would say.
And what inspired the idea for the cabaret?
Well, it's been a growth process. Amanda and I kind of came at it from different sides, but similar time frames. Wanagani is kind of a modern gypsy band.
That's the band that you're in. Yeah.
That's the band that I play in. That we were creating music and trying very much to not sound like anybody else that was out there. We really wanted to define a whole new style, a whole new way of being. And along with that, when we started playing, we wanted it to be more than just music. We were interested in the visual aspects of the music and not just another band that's up there playing. And Amanda can speak for her direction with it, but at the same time, she had a show that she had been doing previous to this. And we just kind of came together with similar ideas at the same time. I'd say Amanda was probably putting it together first as far as getting the actual dancers together and getting a night going and having different kind of music. And then we came into it and added a live music, live original music. I don't mean to speak for you.
No, it's fine. I am a belly dancer and I organize a lot of different belly dance events. And I really wanted to do kind of a club night type thing that was really a variety show. So sort of like vaudeville-ish, but really flashy and fancy, like the Moulin Rouge, and just something really different that incorporated live music and live performers. We have tons of belly dancers in Salt Lake, but we also have tons of different types of performers. Burlesque is really big here. Cirque arts like aerial and hooping is really big. And so there's all this really different, diverse sort of community of artists. And I thought it would be really cool to have like a dance show that wasn't just belly dance and that was set to all live music, so it was more of like an experience. I'm really inspired by groups that are like that, sort of like cabaret, vaudeville.
And what was, if you can recall the exact feeling, what was the feeling like after you threw your first successful cabaret, when all the parts came together, when the music was on and the dancing was great? How did that feel?
Awesome.
You know, it was really rewarding because we really had struggled at this for a long time to get things to come together. You know, it's hard to get the word out about a new event, a new night, and to try to get, you know, performers to catch the vision that we're trying to create here. And for the first little while, we had some bumps and it was a little bit hard. And boy, I tell you, it finally came together this past Christmas time, and you know, everybody just caught on about the same time, and it was huge, and it was just wonderful, and it was just so rewarding. And afterwards, Amanda and I just ran and gave each other a great big hug, just like, yeah, we finally did it. We got people out. It was huge. It was wonderful.
Well, congratulations on that. It's a hard feat to do, to arrange all that stuff, and it must be pretty difficult, I imagine, logistically speaking. When did you first start belly dancing, Amber, and how does that figure into your personal dancing chronology?
I started belly dancing about 20 years ago. I was pretty young, and I've done lots of different types of belly dancing over the years. And for the recent past, I've been more of like a traditional style of belly dancer. You know, I dance to Middle Eastern music. And so this was really sort of an opportunity to work on something a little different, a little more creative and out of the box and wild and fusion-y than anything that I done in the past.
So was belly dancing the first kind of dance that you picked up in general?
Yeah. Belly dancing is pretty much the only thing I've done. I started dancing when I was 11 years old, so I've done it my whole life.
And it's all you need or want, I guess.
I love it. It's all I ever want to do.
It is really fun to watch, I imagine. It's equally fun to do, maybe more so than even watching. And what is the goal of the Underground Cabaret Collective, would you say, Brian?
The goal is to create something that you can't find anywhere else. It's been described as the parties from the old Weimar Republic back in the 20s and 30s when things were just fresh, and that's what we're trying to accomplish with this. Is we want people to come and have their minds blown and see something that they're never going to see anyplace else, because this truly is an original event.
And when you folks aren't organizing or performing in this, how do you occupy your days? Well, what's your day job, if you will?
I'm a desk jockey.
Yeah.
Nothing nearly as glamorous as being a musician in the cabaret, but I am a civil engineer.
So, but it's very interesting you bring your different approaches to life all together. You know, you didn't work together originally like in an office.
No.
It was the arts that brought you together.
Yes.
That's cool. And what kind of performers will we find at a typical underground cabaret night?
Lots of belly dancers, of course. We have different sort of aerial artists like the Lyra. I don't know, it's that hoop that hangs from the ceiling. Aerial silks. We have a pole dancer. An amazing pole dancer who comes and performs for us. We've had different sort of like hoopers, and we've had fire spinners in the past, and just about anything that's like safe and works within the size that we have. We love all different types of performers.
Bar Deluxe has a pretty high ceiling, so that must be great for the aerial art.
Yes, it's great. It's a good opportunity to have that space for that.
And what were you going to say, Brian?
I was going to say, we also have had jugglers and magicians and things like that too. So it's well-rounded. We've also had people coming in and doing henna while everything's going on. You know, we're trying to create something that's just sensual all the way around. You know, it's auditory, it's visual, it's just the sights and sounds and smells. It's just a whole big thing.
And what is the future of the cabaret?
For this upcoming cabaret, we have a lot of really exciting things happening. As well as having our usual show, we're also having a preview of another belly dance show that I am producing in August. It's called the Black Box Belly Dance Affair. And we're going to do like a little sneak preview of the show at the Underground Gypsy Cabaret. And so that's really exciting for us because it gives us a chance to kind of show people other types of belly dancing and maybe get them excited to come to our show on the 18th of August at the Black Box Theater. And we're also having a CD release party for Wanagani. They have just finished a CD, and Brian should probably talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit, if you will, about your band, how long it's been around, and what this new album's about.
Wanagani has been around for, I guess we first started forming about 2 years ago. We wanted to kind of create something. There's no amplifiers, there's no electric music, it's all acoustic instruments that we make it up. We've kind of gone for like an old world folk gypsy band. We have mandolin, accordion, guitar, stand-up bass, flute, lots of different percussion. We have 5 drummers all set. We've been up to as many as 13 people in the band at one time. I think we have a saw player. I can't forget our saw player.
Never forget that.
You can't forget the saw player. So we're about a 10-piece band now, and we started playing out a little over a year ago. And it's just been wonderful ever since. And we started recording this CD last November, and it's just been a process and just, you know, everything that goes into making a CD, it's a lot of hard work. And it's finally done, and it's ready to be released, and so we're gonna celebrate at the cabaret with our CD release party, along with the Black Box Affair.
Yeah, it's really exciting. The unveiling of 2 things.
Yeah.
Also, I wanted to ask about previous performers you've had. You've had bands like Hectocobo there, and you occasionally have other guest artist bands when you folks aren't busy playing. Is that going to be slated for this next event, or is it mainly just your group?
No, it's always, we try to mix things up as much as we can every time. We don't want to have the same show every single time. We've had a myriad of different performers. Le Decolletage is a wonderful band that unfortunately is no longer around. They played a few of these with us. We've had Hectocobo, we've had Rakatanga, which is a great gypsy band. If anybody can track them down, they're well worth it. And this show that we've got coming up, we have Tabla Arabia, we've had Haywire Outfit. Mm-hmm. Just wonderful talents all the way around, from jazz to gypsy to Americana. It's just a nice little slice of something that you don't get all the time. This show coming up, we have a band called South of Ramona that's going to be playing with us. You know, another interesting little snippet for everybody.
Well, thank you both for making Salt Lake City that much more exciting. With your cabaret, we look forward to seeing it. Thanks for coming by.
Sure.
Thank you.
For more info on the cabaret, visit them online at undergroundgypsycabaret.com or search for them on Facebook. It's time once more for our weekly daily calendar rundown. I am joined by Esther Moronio, editorial assistant. Thank you, Esther.
Thank you, JP.
It's always a pleasure to have you back here. I love your preparation for this event. And
always a pleasure to show up Ricky while I'm here.
That's what I'm saying. Basically way better than Ricky. That's all I'm trying to say. And let's start off the week with Tuesday, July 3rd. There's going to be a great show at the Depot if you're into soul Americana music.
Yeah, it's Fits in the Tantrums. And I think they've played here in Salt Lake quite a bit. So come check it out. Should be a good time.
And Thursday, July 5th, the return of the Twilight Concert Series, the first show featuring Beach House and the Walkmen at Pioneer Park. It's going to be pretty amazing by all accounts.
I know. I'm a Beach House fan. Are you? Kind of like how mellow.
Totally. Remember to bring $5 because it costs this year.
Which is a good thing, people. It is.
And Friday, July 6th, it's a new edition of Slug hitting the streets. And also the Rooftop Concert Series, which is down in Provo.
Yeah, I actually headed down there and spoke to some of the organizers this past weekend, and they're super stoked for this summer series, and it should be a good time. We have an article on the series in the June issue of Slug. So the theme of the show is Heartbreakers and American Girls. They're going to be playing covers of Tom Petty, and there's going to be members from the Neon Trees, Fictionist, The Moth and the Flame, Devil Whale, Book on Tapeworm, Lower Lights, and the Blue Aces, a bunch of Salt Lake and Provo bands, basically. And that happens at the Provo Town Square on the roof of the parking garage.
Thus the name of the Rooftop Concert Series. If you like local music, that is one of the better lineups that you could ever hope for. And if you're a fan of Tom Petty, it's doubly awesome.
Okay.
It's birthday time. Are you ready for birthdays?
Yes. So...
just go for it then if you're ready for it.
To start off, we actually have three birthdays on Friday, July 6th. The first one is... well, not necessarily first. Who knows who was born first? I'm not entirely sure on the dates here. But happy birthday to Henry Glashine. He is one of our Slug writers, and he's also on the Napalm Flesh team. You can see much of his work online and in print. Happy birthday to Ryan Perkins. He's an illustrator. He actually illustrated the logo for my beautiful Godzilla column, which I am absolutely in love with. So
I've been wondering who did that. It's really good.
Yeah. So, and he's a... he does this little project called Big Fun. You can look up his stuff online too. So happy birthday, Ryan. And happy birthday to Tim Paxton. He is also one of our designers and illustrators and has done a bunch of our localized posters, actually. So happy birthday to the three of you. So on Sunday, July 8th, we have two more birthdays. Happy birthday to Cody Hudson. He is one of our music writers. Tons of reviews of his in print and online. And happy birthday to Peter Fryer, who is also one of our music writers, kind of deals with more hardcore music, stuff like that. So happy birthday to two awesome contributors.
Thanks, Sister. Great job, as usual, on the birthdays. To backtrack a little bit to Saturday, July 7th, the Alt Press Fest at the Salt Lake City Main Library, which you just heard about earlier in the show. If you didn't, if you missed that segment, go back, check it out. Dylan interviews Rachel of the library and the festival. For more information about events, you can always check out our daily calendar in the back of Slug Magazine. We also have our calendar listed in our iPhone app. So in addition to being able to listen to the podcast episode and read past and current issues of Slug on our iPhone app, you can also find out what's going on in town. It's very easy to use, and I'm sure people, well, a lot of people have downloaded it, so they're using the shit out of it. There, I said it.
Yeah, they are.
It's the best, you know, pocket-sized application, if you will, for finding out where and what is going on in Salt Lake.
It is.
You know, there should be another way that people can get a hold of us.
Well, it turns out that we have a Twitter account. Surprise!
What?
And so, if you would like to hit us up on Twitter, maybe an event that you'd like us to talk about on the podcast, or feedback on one of our episodes, or if you just want to say hello, you know, JP wants more Twitter followers.
I love Twitter. It's the future. Did you know that?
He loves Twitter, because he's not on Facebook.
No, Facebook is for...
Let's watch what we say here, because some of us have Facebook. Including Soundwaves.
Including this? All right, good point.
We are also on Facebook, though, so hit us up there as well if you're not too cool for it like JP is.
I was using proletariat in a jestful manner, so I think Twitter is easier, but that's all. I'm a big fan, and I hope people will tweet at us more often, because I don't think some people know that we have a Twitter account, so thank you for letting them know, Esther.
Yeah, and you can actually find that at twitter.com/slugsoundwaves.
Nice. Nicely done. In general, thank you for your time today, Esther.
Yeah, thank you for having my time.
Shrugboat is the brand new project from producer-musician Brad Butler. He recruited Salt Lake City musicians Lindsay Heath, Cammy Ritchie, and session musicians to put together this ambient debut. Here's Polku from the debut album Sea Ghosts. Thank you. That was Shrug Boat's Polku. They'll be playing their release show on Thursday, July 5th at the Urban Lounge. They'll be playing with Silver Antlers and Palace of Buddies. The show is free. For more info on the band, visit them online at facebook.com/shrugboat. In June 2012, music review site Pitchfork teamed up with video game magazine Killscreen to form Soundplay. It's an interactive program where video game developers were commissioned to create original games based around current music. The games incorporate the songs to create the scenes and characters, as well as the soundtrack to the music, as given to them by Pitchfork. The games incorporate songs to create the scenes and characters, as well as the soundtrack to the music. In June, the first three games were released featuring music from Cut Copy, Matthew Deer, and M83. Slug writer Alex Springer chatted with Jammin' Warren from Killscreen about Soundplay and upcoming games.
What inspired you to create the Soundplay project? Like, what was the kind of, how did that work?
It comes out of our relationship with Pitchfork over the past year and beyond. You know, I was a writer for Pitchfork, and one of our former editors, Chris Dolan, was a writer for Pitchfork, and so we'd always kind of shared an affinity. And, you know, one of the things that Pitchfork has done so well is carve out a niche for people to understand, engage, and discover independent music. And so that was a model for us from an editorial standpoint, because we wanted to do something very different, very similar around games, and that, you know, we felt like there was this wide body of games, particularly those being done in independent game communities, that, you know, need an advocate or someone really to speak for them. So I've been talking to Chris Kasky, Pitchfork's publisher, since the beginning, but about 18 months ago we started talking more formally about figuring out ways that we could actively work together. So, you know, we proposed an editorial collaboration, and, you know, Pitchfork's never really taken any kind of outside editorial work, but it made sense for them to partner with us in terms of providing a channel on Pitchfork site for, you know, for our content. But, you know, outside of that, we were looking for, you know, other forms of editorial expression, whether it be through the Pitchfork Music Festivals or through a program like this. Chris and I have been, you know, we've been talking about, you know, wanting to find something really unique to do as a collaboration together, and we were really fortunate to find a sponsor and a partner in Intel. But, you know, a lot of it just came from, you know, our discussions from these two worlds. And, you know, Pitchfork has obviously been more active in terms of not just writing about music, but sort of creating a music and arts culture through their festivals and the museum events that they do, and through creative executions. And we're very much in the same boat. So, you know, merging together independent musicians with independent game designers seemed like a natural fit.
Definitely, yeah. I think it sounds like you'll probably be able to get some pretty interesting results out of this, I think. So that'll be really cool to see. And that kind of brings me to one of my other questions. Like, where can people go to play these games once they're created? How can people try them out?
Yeah, so the first two are up. You can go to the Soundplay section of Pitchfork's website. It's soundplay.pitchfork.com. Also, if you go to pitchfork.com, it's in their navigation bar at the top. But the first two are up. The first one is with Matthew Deer, Jewett-based ghostly international musician, and Santaragione, who is an Italian art and code team. And then the second title is up as well, which you can also see on the website. But we're really proud of, you know, really proud of both games, and, you know, especially the, you know, the M83 project with Jake, with Chicago-based game designer Jake Elliott, which is more of like a story exploration game. But, you know, we really wanted to find a way to kind of, I mean, the way that most games use music is the game's already done, and then they hire a licensing house or someone to kind of fit music in after the fact. And, you know, we wanted to really use music as an inspiration or a template for gameplay. So the idea is that you shouldn't just take some other track and layer it over top of the game. Mm-hmm. So you think of a game like Tetris, for example, you know, kind of any old music,
right,
you know, could do. It doesn't really affect the experience. I think music maybe gets faster. That might be the one thing. But for most games, you know, music is kind of in the background. But, you know, for these games, it's like, you know, music is a really integral piece of the experience.
What are some challenges that you think video video game designers would have designing a game completely inspired by a song. Like, how is that challenging?
I think a big piece of it is making sure that the gameplay mechanics are actually a complement to the actual song itself. You know, so the way that games communicate is different from other forms of media. They don't just necessarily tell stories like books do, but they communicate ideas and expressions through their gameplay mechanics. So, like, a game like Angry Birds kind of is about destruction, and so it's all about this idea that you're flinging these birds to get back your lost eggs. But what good games will do is they'll sort of take what you're doing in the game and they kind of give it meaning. I mean, again, to use the Tetris example, you know, one of the magical things about Tetris is that everyone in the entire world has had the exact same experience playing Tetris, which is that it starts off really easy and then it gets really, really hard and you freak out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's very hard to do, to create consistent human experiences in any media. So, you know, I think one of the challenges is making sure that the thing that you do in the game, you know, for both of these games, we felt like, you know, for the M83 game, we felt like the spirit of exploration and dialogue was really fitting with the track. We felt like what you were doing in the game was really reflective of, you know, kind of this sense of grandeur, you know, that the track evokes with, you know, Zola Jesus's vocals. And the same thing with Matthew Deere's, you know, Street Song, you know, the inspiration for that kind of being this desolate, kind of open, ambient space. We felt like, you know, kind of creating this sort of Mad Max type environment with an air of mystery, was that was the right thing to be doing to that song. So that's, I think, the biggest challenge, is not just taking any old game design and then just throwing it, you know, kind of throwing it in the mix, but really finding something that you're doing in the game that is a good complement.
So I think some of the most memorable moments I've had playing video games is like when they do, when the music really fits with what's going on. How do you select the game designers that are participating in this project?
I mean, it's a, you know, basically we kind of come up with a list of folks that we think would be good and then approach them one by one. So it's a mixture of taste and availability, you know, kind of the same way that you might put together a music festival. You have a, you know, big list of folks that you'd love to have play, and then you kind of whittle those things down based on who has time or what their schedule's like. So we were really fortunate in terms of being able to, you know, get some of the game designers. I mean, one of the important things to remember is that these guys are, you know, already really well respected in their space. They've been nominated for, you know, independent game design awards, and so we're really happy with the caliber and the talent that we've gotten so far. So we feel very fortunate. But, you know, we play a lot of games, and, you know, we spend a lot of time looking at things I think are interesting, and some of it's, you know, we're looking for a particular visual style, and we think that that's going to work really well. And for some folks, like one of the upcoming games that we're making, a Cut Copy, uses a game designer named Edit Foddy, who actually was Cut Copy's founding bassist.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Now he does ethics at Oxford now, but he makes games on the side, and he's made a couple really popular Flash games. So that was a situation where, you know, the game designer has like a, you know, really, really natural, comfortable fit with the band. And then, you know, some of it's just like we see something really cool online, and, you know, we're like, that would be amazing, you know, to bring those guys in and have them work on this project.
So I have a similar question about the songs. Like, do you have a process for the songs that you pick, or is it kind of the same process?
Well, Pitchfork takes care of the songs, so, you know, they kind of bring those to us. You know, we definitely talk about them, and we make recommendations and talk to the game designers about, you know, who, in terms of Pitchfork bands, but, you know, since they're the experts in music, kind of defer to their eternal wisdom.
Is the song sort of like the soundtrack of the game, or is it like the game is sort of independent of the song?
I mean, we like to think that the music pairs up with the games the way that, say, that someone like Quentin Tarantino really thinks long
okay.
about what music he's using. So there's kind of an interplay between those two things, you know, in that the music is already pre-recorded, so, you know, there's not flexibility there. Although we have, you know, augmented or cut some of the pieces up, like with the M83 track, you kind of hear the song in pieces.
Okay.
As opposed to Street Song, you kind of hear it in full. But, you know, I think the idea is for these two worlds to kind of meet in the middle, and for there to be this, like, you know, sort of mutual sense of artistic expression. There's, you know, game designers get to do their own take, so to speak. Or, you know, you think about, like, you know, Spike Jonze's music videos or something like that, where,
gotcha,
you know, he'd already got a pre-recorded track, but he's able to take a particular piece of music in a visual direction that, you know, fits his needs and desires.
What do you think music adds to the video game experience? Like, it's already kind of interactive, but what does, like, a good musical score kind of add? What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so, you know, I don't like scary movies, but if you've ever watched Psycho, for example,
yeah,
you know, really what makes the shower scene scary is music. I mean, that's
right,
almost... that's almost entire. I mean, obviously, cinematically, the editing and, you know, the choppy edits and whatnot. And I think, you know, the lighting and all that stuff is incredibly important. But the music and the score is what makes it so powerful. You know, same way with, say, Jaws or something like that. And so I think that music, I'm sorry, the games can have a very similar effect in that, you know, if you're playing a game of Monopoly, that you could, you know, basically score a game like that and control maybe what people were feeling. And good music in games, I think, matches, hopefully, what the designer's intent was in terms of reinforcing things that you're already doing in the game. It's, you know, one of the hard things with games is that you often don't have a lot of control over how people might be thinking or feeling at a particular moment. So, you know, good music in games, I think, hopefully reinforces whatever game mechanics are already there. That's when it's done really well. That isn't always the case, and I do think that games do have a, you know, a much longer way to go in terms of figuring out what a holistic approach to putting music in games looks like. I think film is much further along in that respect, but hopefully with projects like ours, that will inspire people to start to play around a bit more and start to think more creatively about how they can get good music into their projects.
Going back to indie game development, I've noticed, just like on the Xbox Arcade and things like that, independent game development's become more popular, more accessible. What do you think some of the reasons behind that phenomenon is?
Well, I mean, I think there's two things. I mean, I think one is distribution. You know, if you look at the early days of video games, you had a similar situation where you had small 1 and 2 man teams who were making games for a wide variety of video game platforms. You know, there were like 9 platforms in the first generation. You know, there were all these different people who had platforms, you know, Magnavox and Coleco and Atari. And now we basically have 3, Nintendo, Microsoft, and PlayStation, so the cost, which means that the cost of development has also gone up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, one of the big things that's happening is there are more distribution outlets now in the past 10 years than there ever have been. And not just the number, but how ubiquitous they've become. So you think about, you know, mobile, whether it's Android or iOS devices, you know, browser-based Flash or HTML5 games, in addition to the traditional video game consoles. If you want to play games, there are lots of things out there for you. I think the other piece of it is that, you know, the average age of the video game player is getting older. Right now it's around 37 years old. So I think that people are looking for experiences that match their maturity in terms of asking large existential questions about, you know, life, meaning, love, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But also in terms of time, you know, people don't have 20, 30 hours a week to play games. So they're looking for things that can fill up, you know, much like a music video. They're looking for things that can fill up 5, 10, 15, 20 minute increments. And I think game designers are recognizing that that's a real opportunity that you can create really meaningful, powerful experiences that don't have to be 60 hours long. So, you know, I think it's just a maturation process. People are getting older, game designers are getting older, and that's a good thing.
To check out the current games and get info on upcoming titles, visit them online at soundplay.pitchfork.com. Thanks for listening to Soundwaves from the Underground. For all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. What are your favorite local albums from 2012 thus far? What's the one song from a Utah band you can't stop listening to? Drop us a line and tell us your favorites for our upcoming local music panel. You can either send an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We may just play you on the show. Also, feel free to go to iTunes and subscribe to the show if you haven't already. Ratings and reviews also help us out. It gives us exposure to more people that may want to find out about events going on in our city and about music nationally and all sorts of events that we cover. So just feel free, if you have a few seconds, to go click on a star rating and maybe write a quick review for us on iTunes. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and is produced by Gavin Sheehan, with associate producers Jeanette D. Moses, Ricky Vigil, Esther Moronio, and Jonathan Paxton.
Our executive producer is Angela H. Brown. Our theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis, with our main logo and art designed by T-Done and technical design by Kate O'Connor. On next week's show, Slack's Saturday's Voyeur, Damn These Heels Film Festival, and the Sugar House Farmers Market. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.